Lee class. We were the survivors, the old men who were on pace to go the long haul. We stopped in the mailroom. In my box were three letters, two branded with logos of colleges, and one from Justin, my best friend back in the Bronx. I was a starter on the Valley Forge basketball team, the only sophomore on the starting squad that year, and the first sophomore starter in over 5 years. I was making a name on the court, and colleges were taking notice, writing me fairly frequently. These two letters, from Lafayette College in Georgetown, were just the most recent. I spent my summers at prestigious basketball camps like Five Star Basketball and Eastern Invitational, camps where college coaches prowl, looking for fresh prospects. I was almost 6 feet tall at the time, with a quick first step, a passion for defense, and an okay jump shot. But I was cocky as hell. I would sit in my room and practice the grip and grin that would take place the day the NBA commissioner announced my name as the Knicks' first round pick in the NBA draft. I would pantomime putting the hat on my head and work on just the right bland lines for the press. Our team works hard in practice, and it pays off in the games. When the game was on the line, my team put its confidence in me, and I'm just thankful things worked out. I believe we can beat any team on any given day, as long as we play our game. One day a few months earlier, my Uncle Howard took me out to shoot hoops at a park in the Bronx. I was telling him about receiving the recruiting letters from colleges, talking about how I knew I could make it to the pros. My uncle was still much stronger than I was, and would use his size to post me up down low, and then execute a quick turnaround hook shot or layup, reminding me that I wasn't quite in the NBA yet. After he finished beating me, we sat next to each other on the side of the court, and he started to spin the ball on his finger. "You know, your game is getting pretty good, and I hope you do make it to the league. Then we'd all be living nice," he said with a smile on his face. "But it is important that you understand that the chances are not in your favor, and you have to have some backup plans." I took the ball out of his hands, wanting to practice my mid-range jump shot instead of listening to a lecture about my future prospects. I stood up, dribbled the ball from side to side, but never took my eyes off him. Probably more to practice keeping my head up than for any other reason. Think about it, man. It's simple math. Only 60 players are chosen in the NBA draft every year. There are 341 Division I schools, each with 13 players on the roster. This makes 4,433 college players who could declare eligibility for the NBA draft. These numbers don't even include Division II or III players, or international players for that matter. My uncle had obviously been practicing this speech. The dose of reality, hidden in the impressive math exhibition, was beginning to bother me. So I cut him off and asked him if he wanted to get another game going. A small smile appeared on his face again, and he pulled himself up using the metal fence that surrounded the court as support. I thought about him now, as I stared at the college seal on the top left corner of the envelope I held. Next, I slipped my finger into the opening of the letter from Justin. Justin and I exchanged dozens of letters after I left the Bronx for Pennsylvania. I was one of the few outlets Justin had, and my leaving wasn't easy on either of us. We'd always been best friends, despite the urging of one of our deans at Riverdale, who'd once pulled Justin to the side and given him a stern warning. "Justin, you are a good kid. You need to stay away from Wes, or you will end up going nowhere just like he will." Justin simply shook his head and ignored him. It amazed Justin how easily they could write off a 12-year-old. The letter opened with the normal trivial catching up jokes, but it soon became more serious. Two pieces of news took the wind out of me. First, Shea had been arrested on drug charges. These weren't simply running or possession charges either. Possession with the intent to distribute was a charge of a completely different magnitude, with serious mandatory sentences. Justin hadn't seen Shea around the neighborhood for a while, and from the sound of it, was not sure when he would again. The even more devastating piece of news was that Justin's mother was dying. We had noticed changes in his mother for a few years. She moved more slowly than usual and seemed just a beat off. Justin's mother had Hodgkin's disease, a rare form of cancer. The survival rate is around 90% for those who discover it early. Unfortunately, his mother was in the other 10%. With Justin's older sister away in college and his father living in Harlem, Justin's role in the family was changing. Justin was now spending his mornings with her at the hospital, his afternoons at school, then running the basketball practice and back to the hospital. His grades fell dramatically as the burden began to wear him down. I was halfway through reading the letter when Sean's voice broke my concentration. You ready, man? I got nothing. I took one final glance at the letter, then carefully folded it back into its envelope and put it in the cargo pocket of my camouflage battle dress uniform. Sean noticed the look on my face and said, You all right, man? Everything okay? I told him everything was fine, but a few seconds later, I spoke up again. Hey, Sean, do you ever think about what life would be like if we never came here? He looked at me quizzically. I don't know. About the same, I guess. Yeah, I guess. Even though I'd grown to love military school, I still had mixed feelings about being there, and they were eating at me. I wanted to be at home, to talk to Justin after he'd left the hospital. I didn't know what I'd say, but at least I'd be there. I wanted to be there as my mother and Shiny moved back to Maryland and Shiny began high school. I remember what Baltimore could be like, and I wanted to be there to protect Shiny and help my mother through the move. I felt like being in military school was keeping me in a bubble, ignorant of what was going on with my people on the outside. There was a comfortable distance between my life now and the levels of confusion that had engulfed me just a few years ago. This uniform had become a force field that kept the craziness of the world outside from getting too close to me, but I wondered if it was just an illusion. H Company was broken up into two platoons. I was the platoon sergeant for one of them, and a cadet named Dalio was the platoon sergeant for the other. In the Army, there is an old expression that the officers make the orders and the sergeants do all the work. This year, as a cadet platoon sergeant, I was learning how true that was. From the moment I woke up to the moment I went to bed, my day was consumed with thinking about my platoon, taking care of them, making sure they were doing well in class, making sure things were fine at home, making sure the building was clean, and on, an exhausting litany. Saturday evening, after taps, Dalio and I put our guys to sleep, but still had a few hours of leave before we had to be back on campus. Want to go grab a stromboli? Dalio asked. The stromboli is a staple in Pennsylvania cuisine, essentially consisting of a pizza folded on itself, a bread, dairy, and meat concoction held together with copious amounts of grease, classic adolescent comfort food. I was in. We threw on our dress gray uniforms, including the gray wool pants that scraped every blade of hair off our legs, and dark blue cotton shirts. I tightened the navy tie that accompanied the uniform. The tie was wrapped in the same knot I'd used as a freshman. When you know how to get there, downtown Wayne is only 15 minutes away from campus. We strolled down the barely lit street, gossiping about the antics of our platoons. About 10 minutes into the walk, a red Toyota slowly drove up to us. Thinking the driver just needed directions or help navigating the dark, signless streets, we stopped and peered in. As the driver's window rolled halfway down, the sound of loud rock music and the smell of alcohol met us. What are you guys doing? A slightly overweight teenager with unkempt black hair and a distinctive scar across the top of his forehead asked us. Nothing, I replied. Who is this guy? I wondered. Don't you mean nothing, sir? A voice rang out from the back seat, but with the tinted windows, we couldn't see its source. Nothing, sir, I reflexively corrected myself, even without knowing who made the order. I was so accustomed to the rules and protocol on campus that it took me a second to realize I might be responding to the orders of some random drunk kids from town. I'm Colonel Bose's son, and not only are you rude, but your uniforms are in disarray. I'm going to report you both. Dalio and I looked at each other, confused about whether this was a legitimate complaint or simply a prank. Dalio realized the pizza shop would be closing soon, so he tried to end the conversation. Well, you have our names, so do what you have to do, he said. The car sped away, leaving a trail of blaring music behind it. Dalio and I continued walking down the middle of the street, but our conversation now turned to the odd interaction we just had. What do you think? Dalio asked me. Probably nothing, just a bunch of idiots. Suddenly a speeding car came roaring up behind us. We turned around with just enough time to jump out of the way as the red Toyota from before came within feet of running us both over. We lay there in complete bewilderment, unsure what to do next. The car slowed to a creep after missing us, like a confused predator who'd overrun his prey. Finally, the brake lights appeared. Dalio and I got off the ground, looked at each other, and broke into a sprint, running away from the car now sitting ominously a few yards from us. Just then, another car came down the street. Our drunk attackers were forced to keep moving. Dalio looked at me and said, "What the hell are we supposed to do?" That's when the kid from the Bronx started to elbow the cadet sergeant aside. "We keep going to get our pizza. They're done for the night, and if they aren't, we'll see them when they get out of the car," I told him. Dalio was not as convinced, but after kneeling behind a parked car for a few minutes and not hearing or seeing any sign of the red Toyota, he decided that I might be right. Besides, he was still hungry. We picked up our pace as we walked in the shadows of the tree-lined sidewalks, now avoiding the center of the street. I felt like I was doing my speed walk to the subway in the Bronx again. Every car that passed made our hearts stop. This was military school, I thought to myself. We were supposed to be protected from this kind of stuff. We came to an intersection, one of the few lighted paths on our entire journey. Only 200 yards away from our final destination. The quiet streets and passing minutes without incident had returned our focus to the oozing Stromboli and not the Toyota. We were crossing the intersection when I heard a voice yelling, "Go home, nigger!" As I turned my head to see where the yell came from, a rock or bottle, something hard, slammed against my mouth. "I just got hit!" I yelled to Dalio, spitting out blood and pieces of tooth into my hand. My tongue searched my top row of teeth, scratching against my now sharp and jagged front tooth, while my mouth filled with blood. We realized the car had been sitting with its headlights off, waiting for us. After their direct hit, they put on their lights and screeched off. Inside, they were still screaming with laughter. Going to the pizza shop was now off the table. We realized who the target was. I reached into my mouth and wiggled my loose tooth. We moved to a completely dark area behind a collection of bushes to regroup. Dalio, not panicking, said, "Bro, we have got to get back to campus now." My mouth was aching. I was beside myself with anger, and still confused and embarrassed. Embarrassed to be called a nigger in front of my comrade, and embarrassed by my reaction. Because after being called a nigger and having my tooth broken, I decided to flee back to campus. Should I have stayed there in the middle of the street, waiting for the boys to come back, somehow gotten them out of their car and tested them blow for blow? Part of me was aghast when I decided that the answer was no. I'd only waded into street life in the Bronx. I never got into its deepest, darkest waters. But I'd been around enough street cats to know the code. They hit you with a knife, you find a gun. And I didn't have to be a Black Panther to know the nigger was the ultimate fighting word. This was the kind of knowledge we understood, the kind of code that was so deeply fundamental it never had to be fully articulated. But I had to let this one go. I had to look at the bigger picture. My assailant was unknown, unnamed, and in a car. This was not a fair fight, and the best case scenario was nowhere near as probable as the worst case scenario. If I was successful, who knew how the fight would have ended? If I failed, who knew how the fight would have ended? I thought about my mother and how she would feel if this escalated any further. I thought about my father and the name he chose for me. We sat silent for a moment, waiting for any movement or lights. But as we just learned, darkness and silence did not translate to safety. I told Dalio we had to get back to campus by a different route, one where there were no lights and no streets. I told him to follow me and began to run through a series of front yards to a dark, empty field about a quarter mile from where we started. Dalio was trying to ask me where we were going, but I never slowed or turned around to explain. We did not have time. Hiding behind trees and cars along the way, we systematically moved closer to our goal. The veil of security I thought the uniform provided had been lifted, and now we hustled in our black dress shoes and stained wool pants through dirty fields and grassy yards. Our hearts pounded under our navy blue shirts. "Where are we?" Dalio asked again when we stopped behind a large rock, staring at the wooded landscape in front of us. "It's the field that leads us back to school," I replied. This was our chance to get on campus without having to meet up with our attackers again. Dalio had never been here, and most cadets never had a reason to. I had, however. It was one of the first memories I had of my school. This was the same area I'd run through trying to find the Wayne train station, trying to escape. "Let's go," I whispered, and we bolted into the woods. Scared and angry, we navigated the darkness holding on to trees, using the moon as our guide. Minutes later, we saw the light from the cross perched on the chapel's roof, which was only 50 yards away from our barracks. The irony of the situation forced me to smile, featuring my newly cracked tooth. Years earlier, I had run through these same woods with all of my might, looking for safety, trying to get away from campus. Tonight, I ran through the same woods looking for safety, but in the other direction. Part 3. Paths taken and expectations fulfilled. I sat again in that large, gray, windowless room with about 30 other people waiting to see their fathers, husbands, sons, boyfriends, and friends. The air in the room was heavy and cold, the chairs hard. There was a vending machine with only a few sad items dangling inside. Small lockers lined the gray walls. We were told to place whatever we carried with us inside them. Nothing unaccounted for could go in, or out of, the secured room that would be our next stop. Out of the 30 people in the room, I was one of only two men. The rest were women and children. One by one, the guards called out numbers. After about an hour of waiting, I finally heard mine. I quickly rose and walked over to the desk where bulletproof glass separated me from a corrections officer. The officer threw out the same barrage of questions they always ask. What's your relation to the inmate? Do you have any electronic equipment or sharp items? Do you have any items you plan on passing on to the inmate? Eventually, they let me into the visitor's room, where I waited for Wes to be escorted in. I wasn't even there that day. I looked at Wes, speechless. He still didn't admit to the armed robbery that led to his final imprisonment. There were days when our unexpected relationship started to seem absurd. What was I doing here anyway? More than 3 years earlier, I had written a letter to a stranger whose story had sat with me for years. We shared a name, but the truth was I didn't know this man. He was simply an address, a P.O. box, and a personal identification number. A man convicted of murder. And inevitably, as in every convict cliche I'd ever heard, he claimed innocence. But I started to think more about his repeated defense, offered again and again in earnest. I wasn't even there that day. Did he think that through repetition, it would become true? That if he just incanted the phrase enough, the prison walls would collapse and he'd be able to walk back home? Did he think it could reverse time? How far back would he have to go to be innocent again? Wes folded his hands together. His broad shoulders leaned in. We were nearing the end of our get-together. Silence now overrode the conversation. He smiled. I decided not to respond directly to this latest protest of his innocence. Instead, I asked a question. Do you think we're all just products of our environments? His smile dissolved into a smirk, with the left side of his face resting at ease. I think so, or maybe products of our expectations. Others' expectations of us, or our expectations for ourselves? I mean, others' expectations that you take on as your own. I realized then how difficult it is to separate the two. The expectations that others place on us help us form our expectations of ourselves. We will do what others expect of us, Wes said. If they expect us to graduate, then we'll graduate. If they expect us to get a job, we will get a job. If they expect us to go to jail, then that's where we'll end up too. At some point, you lose control. I sympathized with him, but I recoiled from his ability to shed responsibility seamlessly and drape it at the feet of others. True, but it's easy to lose control when you were never looking for it in the first place. An hour later, our time was up, and he was escorted out as quickly as he entered. I sat in the room alone, collecting my thoughts. I had more questions than I came in with. Chapter 7. The Land That God Forgot. 1997. 5 minutes! The jump master yelled from the front of a C-130 military aircraft. 5 minutes! My entire chalk of airborne candidates yelled back at him in the military's famous call-and-response cadence. We all knew what was next. And now, We knew how long we had before it was time to face it. 5 minutes. I stood toward the middle of the C-130, staring at the back of another soldier's Kevlar helmet. The late summer Georgia heat beat down on the metal shell of the airplane that we'd been packed into for over an hour. Sweat that had been beating all over my face was now streaming uncontrollably, but afraid to move, I simply let it fall. The only relief came from the open door at the front of the plane that our instructors, the Black Hats we call them, occasionally looked out to inspect our drop zone. A Black Hat would brace his hands against each side of the door and stick his head into the open air, slowly turning from side to side to check for any potential obstacles. I had gotten used to the 50 pounds of gear cumbersomely strapped to my back, torso, and legs. My bladder verged on explosion because of the crazy amount of water we were forced to drink to stay hydrated. None of this now mattered. I was about to jump out of the plane. I was about to become a paratrooper. An excited nervousness overwhelmed me. It had been a little more than a year since I decided to make the Army a fundamental part of my future. As my high school career was coming to an end, I was still being avidly recruited by college programs. The New York Times had even run a 2-page article on my high school sports career and future prospects. I got a first-hand taste of the athletic campus visitation process, complete with young and attractive tour guides who showed me around and made me feel welcome and wanted. It was a seductive ego stroke. Initially, it just reinforced my belief that I was special, that I was chosen. The young female admirers who seemed to come along with the package added to the allure. But eventually, all of these treats started to feel meaningless. As I began to play against nationally ranked players at various tournaments and camps, I realized that the disparity between my potential and theirs was glaring. I played hard while they played easy, with a gracefulness and effortlessness that I lacked. When you step on the court with players like Kobe Bryant or 6'8" point guards who can dunk from the free throw line, your mind begins to concentrate on your other options. I realized I had to make sure these schools knew my name regardless of what I did on the 90 feet of hardwood that had brought me to their attention. Just as military school had slowly grown in me, so had academic life. I actually liked reading now. My mother, sensing my apathy towards reading, had bought me the Mitch Albom book Fab Five. The book is about the Michigan basketball team led by Chris Webber, Jalen Rose, and Juwan Howard, a team with five freshman starters who made it all the way to the national championship game. The Fab Five sported baggy shorts, bald heads, and a swagger I recognized from the streets of the Bronx, all reflective of the way the hip-hop generation was changing the face of sports, and college basketball in particular. I was riveted by that book. The characters jumped off the page, and I felt myself as engulfed in their destiny as I was in my own. I finished Fab Five in 2 days. The book itself wasn't what was important. In retrospect, I see that it was a great read, but hardly a work of great literature. But my mother used it as a hook into a deeper lesson, that the written word isn't necessarily a chore, but can be a window into new worlds. From there, I leapt into every new book with fervor. My fresh love of reading brought me to the transformative writers who have worked their magic on generations of readers. I explored Spain with Paulo Coelho. I listened to jazz on the North Shore of Long Island with F. Scott Fitzgerald. I was reminded by Walt Whitman to think of the past, and I awaited The Fire Next Time with James Baldwin. But there was a more recent author and public figure whose work spoke to the core of a new set of issues I was struggling with, the Bronx's own Colin Powell. His book, My American Journey, helped me harmonize my understanding of America's history and my aspiration to serve her in uniform. In his autobiography, he talked about going to the Woolworths in Columbus, Georgia, and being able to shop, but not eat there. He talked about how black GIs during World War II had more freedoms when stationed in Germany than back in the country they fought for. But he embraced the progress this nation made and the military's role in helping that change to come about. Colin Powell could have been justifiably angry, but he wasn't. He was thankful. I read and reread one section in particular. The Army was living the democratic ideal ahead of the rest of America. Beginning in the 50s, less discrimination, a truer merit system, and leveler playing fields existed inside the gates of our military posts than in any southern city hall or northern corporation. The Army, therefore, made it easier for me to love my country with all its flaws, and to serve her with all of my heart. The canon of Black autobiography sensibly includes scores of books about resistance to the American system. For instance, reading The Autobiography of Malcolm X, a book that begins and ends in the madness and pathology of America's racial obsessions, is a rite of passage for young Black men. Malcolm never stopped pursuing truth in the right course, based on the best information he had at any given moment. His response to the world he confronted in the middle of the 20th century was profound and deeply felt. But he didn't speak to my experience as well as Colin Powell did. Powell, in his pragmatic way, wanted what I wanted. A fair shot. A place to develop himself. A code that would instill discipline, restrain passion, and order his steps. A way to change the world without first unleashing the whirlwind. In the chaos of the world I grew up in, those were as appealing to me as Malcolm's cry for revolution was to his generation. I don't claim that Powell had it all figured out. American history bedevils the most earnest attempts to make sense of it. And of course, the problems of race that Malcolm confronted have not disappeared by any means. But Powell gave me another way to think about the American dilemma, and more than that, another way to think about my own life. As I started to think seriously about how I could become the person I wanted to be, I looked around at some of the people who'd had the biggest impact on my life. Aside from family and friends, the men I most trusted all had something in common. They all wore the uniform of the United States of America. I thought about Lieutenant Colonel Murnane, my 10th and 11th grade history and social studies teacher, who lit a fire in me about the importance of public service. I sat in the front of his class, entranced as he spoke about the Constitutional Congress and the Federalist Papers, and their relevance to our existence today. I thought about Rear Admiral Hill, the former superintendent of the Naval Academy, who served as president of Valley Forge in my last 3 years of high school. Admiral Hill had thousands of cadets, faculty, staff, alumni, and trustees to deal with on a daily basis, but always made it a point to know the names and stories of as many cadets as he could. He also taught me an important lesson about leadership. It always comes with having to make tough decisions. I thought about Colonel Billy Murphy, the commandant of cadets. He was one of the most intimidating but fair men I have ever met. He and his command sergeant major, Harry Harris, demanded excellence from every unit, every platoon, and every cadet. They believed that excuses were tools of the incompetent and forced every cadet to believe the same. One of the last times I saw Colonel Murphy was in our chapel. I sat toward the front. The hard wooden pews forced us to sit up straight, and the message coming from the pulpit demanded everyone's attention. Colonel Murphy ascended to the podium, looking as strong as ever, his eyes still alit with a sense of purpose. Then he announced that he was leaving Valley Forge to undergo treatment for his advanced-stage cancer. He said something I will never forget. "When it's time for you to leave this school, leave your job, or even leave this earth, you make sure that you've worked hard to make sure it mattered that you were ever here." The notion that life is transient, that it can come and go quickly, unexpectedly, had been with me since I had seen my own father die. In the Bronx, the idea of life's impermanence underlined everything for kids my age. It drove some of us to a paralyzing apathy, stopped us from even thinking too far in the future. Others were driven to what, in retrospect, was a sort of permanent state of mourning for our loved ones, who always seemed at risk, and for our own lives, which felt so fragile and vulnerable. But I started to see it a little differently that day. Life's impermanence, I realized, is what makes every single day so precious. It's what shapes our time here. It's what makes it so important that not a single moment be wasted. My next decision was clear. I wanted to stay at Valley Forge and attend its junior college, which would allow me to go through the early commissioning process, receive my associate's degree, and become a second lieutenant in the Army. I wanted to lead soldiers.
3 minutes! The Black Cats yelled out. 3 minutes!
We replied with a good deal less gusto. I looked around the plane at the faces of my fellow prospective paratroopers. The U.S. Army Airborne School is a collection of soldiers, sailors, airmen, marines, coast guardsmen, cadets, and anyone else who has received the funding and possesses the will to become airborne qualified. Some of the attendees needed the qualification to advance in their careers. For example, those planning to join a Ranger Battalion or one of the elite Army units like the 82nd Airborne Division needed to be qualified as paratroopers. For some attendees, whose career goals didn't involve combat, it was a way to get a taste of what the combat experience feels like. For all of us, however, it was, at this moment, terrifying. For some of my chalk, this was the first genuine military activity they would engage in. For a few, this was the first airplane ride they had ever taken. These few, even after today, still wouldn't have had the experience of landing in an airplane. Just taking off and jumping out. Broad smiles and hollow laughter were undermined by trembling legs and shaking hands. Our sweat-stained uniforms, still dusty from the endless push-ups and practice jump landings in man-made pits overflowing with sawdust from our first week, clung to our skin. My left hand grasped the yellow ripcord for dear life as my right hand pressed against the sidewall of the C-130 for balance. That bright yellow cord was my lifeline. If it failed, the reserve parachute that was strapped to my belly like a baby kangaroo would be my last hope. A week before I boarded the most memorable plane ride of my life, Valley Forge had selected me to be the regimental commander for the 70th Corps of Cadets. This meant that I would be the highest-ranking cadet in the entire Corps of over 700 people. I would be responsible for their training, health, welfare, morale, and success. I remembered watching the regimental commander my first year at Valley Forge with a simultaneous fear and awe. On his command, the entire Corps moved. Wherever he stepped on campus, cadets snapped to attention. Every cadet possessed a burning desire to be recognized, but never noticed, as his piercing blue eyes evaluated his Corps. Now, days after I became a qualified paratrooper, I would take on that role. The plane steadied as we neared our drop zone. At 1,800 feet in the air, the large aircraft began to cruise and prepare to offload its 20 aspirants. I was only 18 years old, the youngest in my chalk. When I was commissioned, less than a year from that moment, I was told I was one of the youngest officers in the entire United States military. My platoon sergeant would probably be older than my mother. My company commander would probably have over a decade of life on me. It was one thing leading cadets, but would I honestly be ready at such a young age to lead soldiers? My mind began racing again when a command brought me back to reality.
1 minute! 1 minute!
My mind retraced my 3 weeks of training in 15 seconds. I remembered the components of landing. When I landed, I needed to make sure that my feet and knees stayed together, that my eyes stayed focused on an object in the distance, not on the ground, and that my 5 points of contact hit the ground in order. Balls of my feet, sides of my calves, hips, lats, and shoulders. It seems much easier than it actually is. Jumping from a plane the wrong way or landing the wrong way could lead to serious injuries, even the kind after which you can't tell the war stories the next day. Step out with one leg, chin tight against my chest, right hand on the handle of my reserve parachute. Do I count to three or count to four before pulling my reserve? Which way do I pull my parachute slips if the wind is blowing left to right? Damn, I can't remember. Is that minute up yet? My mind and my nerves were on edge. The Black Hats yelling, "Get ready, Airborne!" brought me back to task. Our Black Hats always told us to remember three things as we were jumping. Trust your equipment, trust your training, and trust your God. As we were seconds away from taking the leap, the multitude of prayers that left the plane were palpable. I stared at the yellow light at the front of the plane, waiting for it to turn green. I spoke with God, asking him to watch over me and the others on the plane. The excessively hot and cramped conditions, coupled with the fact that some of the toughest schools in the military take place at Fort Benning, have earned the base the nickname, the land that God forgot. I was hoping he'd remember us today. The formalities that usually accompany my prayers, "Dear Most Heavenly Father and Most Gracious and Everlasting God," were replaced with very simple, blunt, and direct requests like, "Help!" and "Please don't let me die like this!" Before I could even finish my prayer, the yellow light disappeared, and a bright green one lit up right above it. "Green light, go!" The soldiers, airmen, marines, sailors, coast guardsmen, cadets, and everyone else in front of me began to shuffle their feet toward the door. It reminded me of commuters leaving a packed subway car, an odd resonance as I approached the open door 2,000 feet in the air. We had heard stories during training about people who, after a Black Hat yelled "green light, go," had tried to stay in the plane. They were lifted off their feet by the jump masters and thrown out. To keep the flow of bodies moving in rhythm and to make sure that all of us landed in the drop zone and not in someone's yard somewhere in Alabama. I shuffled my feet toward the door as the population of the aircraft methodically decreased. My colleagues, I realized, were all now flying through the air beneath me. Suddenly, the only person in front of me was the jumpmaster. He stared at me. We were so close I could see my distorted reflection in his large Ray-Bans. His cheeks were flapping from the wind blowing against his face. I handed him my yellow ripcord, yelled, "Airborne, jumpmaster!" and turned my body to face the open door. I closed my eyes and felt the air just below me flying by. I assumed the proper position, and somehow my left leg stepped out over the edge of the doorway. Instantly, my entire body was sucked out of the plane, and I heard, felt, the aircraft speed away. I thrashed around in the wind. It wasn't me who controlled my movements, but the rushing air around me. I rotated in darkness because I refused to open my eyes. I was counting in my mind, as I was instructed to, and as I hit the longest 3 seconds of my life, I felt a sudden jerk, and my body was lifted dozens of feet when my main parachute automatically opened. With that tug, I finally opened my eyes, looked up, and to my relief, saw a perfectly symmetrical and hole-free canopy above me. I felt a cocktail of beautiful emotions coursing through me. Peace, love, appreciation. I looked down at the trees waving in the distance, and the gorgeous brown Alabama soil that seemed to be rising to meet me. My equipment was functional, my training was sound, my faith confirmed. I cut through the sky, the wind whipping against my face as I kept my eyes high, staring intently at the horizon.
Cheryl, wake up! What the hell is wrong with you?
Wes took the face of his third and fourth children's mother in his hands and began to shake her. She lay on the couch, saliva dripping out of the corners of her mouth onto her red Gap t-shirt. Her pupils dilated and rolling to the back of her head, heroin still flowing through her veins. Wes ran to the kitchen and rushed back to her with a glass of water, splashing some on her face and pouring some down her throat until she came to. This was not the first time she had gotten high like this, but it was the first time Wes had seen it. Wes had met Cheryl years before, while he was still living in Dundee Village. She lived down the street from Alicia in a two-bedroom house with her son. She was older than Wes, already 23 when they met, but a relationship developed. His two children with Alicia came back-to-back, born in 1992 and 1993. His children with Cheryl came in the same fashion, born in 1995 and 1996.
"Where did you get this from?"
Wes asked, but Cheryl just kept repeating the same response, as if they were the only words she knew.
"I'm sorry."
Wes cursed himself. He knew he had been turning a blind eye to telltale signs that things were moving in this direction. Just a month ago, he'd noticed he was missing money and lectured Cheryl.
"Stop bringing your friends into my house or they're going to be stealing my stuff."
She agreed, and the conversation had ended. But the problem was not solved. Before that, he confronted her after finding a pipe in her closet.
"Wes, do you think I'd be using while I'm pregnant?"
she'd asked. He let the matter drop. His love for her and their kids kept him from seeing the truth that now stared him in the face. Cheryl was an addict. The sight of her coming off her high, stumbling to the bathroom, disgusted Wes. He saw this every day. The people who would line up around the corner for drugs. The people who would do anything to score. He knew these people because he was the one who got them what they needed. It was his job. And it pained him to realize that the mother of his children was just like them. Wes grabbed his keys and walked out the door. He wasn't sure where he was going, but he knew he couldn't stay there. Wes was tired. Tired of being locked up, tired of watching drugs destroy entire families, entire communities, an entire city. He was tired of being shot at and having to attend the funerals of his friends. He understood that his thoughts contradicted his actions. He had long since accepted that. It was just that his tolerance of his own hypocrisy was wearing thin. He walked down the broken blocks, past clutters of abandoned buildings, the glass from shattered windows on the sidewalk, junkies on the steps. He walked for miles through a steady drizzle, trying to clear his mind, while 13-year-olds ran drugs up and down the streets. Wes turned down Edmondson Avenue, walking toward his friend Levy's house. Levy was a bit younger than Wes, but had managed to get out of the hustling game a few months back. At first, Wes had been confused by Levy's decision. Why would he give up so much money to go straight? But days like today were making Wes think that maybe Levy was the smart one. The rain began to subside as Wes approached Levy's house. He walked up the stairs and rang the doorbell. When Levy saw Wes, his face lit up.
Wes, what's good, yo?
Levy said with his distinctive Baltimore drawl, a trace of a southern twang with words contracted and vowels swallowed.
Come in, come in.
Wes sat on the couch in the middle of the room, his shoulders slumped, his eyes downward.
I'm done, man, he said. I want to get out, do something different with my life. But I'm not sure what. I'm not going back to high school. I'm too old for that.
But I'm tired of running these streets. Levy went to the kitchen for a couple sodas and sat on the couch next to Wes.
Listen, there are definitely some options, but I'm telling you, it won't be easy. It will take work. It will take commitment. Even when the days are tough, you've got to push through. Feel me?
Yeah, man. I'm ready to try something. Anything. Levy told Wes about Job Corps, a program he was about to enter. Started in 1964 as a federal initiative, Job Corps was designed to help disadvantaged youth. It was part of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society and was modeled after the Depression era's Civilian Conservation Corps. Levy was hoping to become its newest recruit. Levy would be entering the Job Corps as a high school dropout, but was hoping to leave with a general equivalency diploma, GED, and the skills to help him land a job as a hot water boiler repairman. He knew the pay would be lower than what he was making on the streets, but the work was steady and honest, and he would have more time to give his family without injury, death, or incarceration looming. Wes told him he would think about it. Levy found a piece of paper and wrote down a date and an address.
This is where you go if you're serious about Job Corps. It doesn't take much, just come through. They'll handle all the rest.
Wes had heard about the Job Corps before. His Aunt Virginia had started Job Corps but didn't finish. She said it was too much like jail. What Levy was talking about seemed different, but Wes wasn't sure which version to believe. As he walked away from Levy's house, Wes pondered other reasons to be doubtful about Job Corps. He had two babies' mothers, four kids, and his own mother to take care of. Wes stepped along beneath streetlights in a quarter moon. The day was coming to an end, but he knew it would be a long night. Wes looked down at his forearm, at the newest addition to the gallery of images inked on his body. A few weeks back, Wes and three of his friends had gone to a tattoo parlor in Baltimore and all gotten the same design permanently inked on their bodies, a black devil's head with horns and sinister eyes. His skin had almost healed, but the pain behind the tattoo was as fresh as ever. When the three arrived at the shop, they'd searched for a symbol that best represented their allegiance to one another and their shared situations. When he was growing up, Wes would occasionally follow his mother to the new Metropolitan Church on Sunday, but even on his sporadic visits, he never felt any connection. He would watch the singing and dancing, cheering and crying, and chalk it all up to theatrics. Wes would wonder if anyone there even knew who or what they were praying to. Where was God when people didn't make enough money to feed their families? Where was God when kids were selling rocks at 12 years old and their parents encouraged it because the kids were the main breadwinners in the home? Where was God when a young boy came home from a school that was as uninterested in him as he was in it? Where was God when a kid had a question and looked to his friends in the streets for an answer because his father was locked up and his mother strung out? Wes remembered leaning back in the black padded parlor chair and taking a puff on his blunt as the tattoo artist sealed the ink into his skin. Fuck God, he said, drawing in a lungful of smoke. If he does exist, he sure doesn't spend any time in West Baltimore. After agonizing over it, Wes decided to go with Levy to his final Job Corps interview. While there, Wes sat down with a counselor and began a conversation. Do you have a high school degree?
No,
Wes replied. Do you have a record?
Yes.
Are you interested and serious about this program? After receiving the same deployment date as Levy, Wes understood that the only question he was asked that mattered was the last one. When the time came, he packed his bags and said goodbye to his family. Where he was going, he had to go on his own. 2 weeks after his conversation with Levy, Wes stood in a parking lot on the corner of Saratoga and Green Streets, waiting for the bus that would take him to the Woodland Job Corps Center in Laurel. The Sunday evening air seemed unusually still as the baby blue school bus rolled. The bus was packed with a motley group of men and women who represented a spectrum of ages, neighborhoods, backstories, and motivations. But they were united in looking for a new chance. They believed the secret to their second lives hid on the sleepy Howard County, Maryland campus of Job Corps. Most everyone on the bus slept during the 30-minute ride, but Wes sat up, staring out the window, wondering about the next few months. He'd been assured during his interview that he would be allowed to return home every weekend if he chose to, and could make a few calls during the week. He was assured he'd be able to bring his music and have time to work on his lyrics. He was told that if he was willing to put in the work, he would leave the program a different person. The bus finally entered the Job Corps campus. The dark night appeared even darker as they pushed down a long asphalt road. A tree canopy seemed to collapse over the bus as they slowed to a creep. Wes noticed goalposts to his right, and assuming they indicated a football field, he smiled. The bus stopped at a welcome center and unloaded. The passengers formed a line, awaiting room assignments. When Wes got to the front of the line, an attractive woman in her mid-30s stood before him with a clipboard and a smile. "Welcome to Laurel. What's your last name?" she said. Wes told her his name, and she gave him his room assignment. He stood there smiling at the girl until she nodded at him, as if to say, "Okay, you got your room, now move on." Wes got the hint, grabbed his bags, and carried them along the concrete walkways curving through manicured lawns that led to his dorm. As he walked, his eyes took in the campus. He noticed a beach volleyball court complete with sand, a full basketball court with regulation lines and nets for the rims set next to a beautiful wooden gazebo. This was exactly what Wes imagined a college campus would look like. He had never seen anything like it before. When Wes arrived in his room, he found Levy lying back on the bed, his feet crossed and hands behind his head with his fingers interlocked, smiling. Wes smiled back at him, relieved to see a living piece of home so far away. The spacious room was far from the prison-like image his Aunt Virginia had painted for him. "So far, so good," Wes said, as he dropped his bags and lay on his bed, imitating Levy's leisurely pose. In the first phase of Job Corps, students are tested to place them at the right level of GED training. One day after they took the test, the results came back. Levy needed to go through the full month-long pre-GED training. Wes, by contrast, finished near the top of his class. He completed the coursework and received his GED a month later. He was already reading at the level of a sophomore in college. His quick success had Wes thinking differently about his life. He proudly displayed his new diploma at home, excitedly mounting it one weekend in a frame he'd bought the week he received his test scores. The bus would bring him back to Baltimore City every Friday evening, but much of his weekend was spent preparing for the next week in Laurel. Many of the other students were now looking to Wes for help with their GED prep, for assistance with their personal issues, and for friendship. Just as he had on the corners of Baltimore, Wes became a leader. After completing his academic coursework, Wes started on his professional training. He selected carpentry as his vocational specialty. He had always been handy. Years ago, the siding had begun to fall off his mother's house. His brother, Tony, held the siding level as Wes's steady hand nailed the replacement into place. The crack of the hammer as it connected with the head of the nail. The way the body of the nail disappeared into the siding. The joy of admiring a finished product. The quiet thrill of a job well done. He enjoyed building, but was now motivated to learn true skills. After the mandatory training sessions on the use of the equipment and safety precautions, the teacher told the class he wanted them to create something on their own. The teacher made Wes laugh. He was thin and balding and full of old jokes, but Wes appreciated his skill and his commitment to this group of young men about whom no one else seemed to care. As Wes thought about what he wanted to make, the image of his 5-year-old daughter came to him. For much of her life, Wes had been gone. Whether at the Job Corps or behind bars, he had missed many of the milestones in her growing up. The situation at home had become even more tenuous. Cheryl's drug problem had become more consuming and overt. The kids were now basically living with Wes's mom. Cheryl complained, but never made a real effort to take the kids back. She knew what everyone around her knew. She was in no position to take care of her own children. Wes had to reconsider what it meant to be a father. He wanted to protect his young daughter, shelter her. One by one, the students declared what they were going to make. the list of objects blurred together, small pieces of furniture and little decorative items, until it was Wes's turn. He had tuned out the conversation around him to become lost in thoughts about his family. The teacher repeated the question to Wes. All Wes could think about was his daughter. Without a thought about what he was taking on, he announced that he wanted to build her a house. The teacher raised his eyebrows and said, "Interesting. A small house?" Wes looked back at the teacher, but in his mind he was looking at the house he wanted to build. No, a house big enough for her to get in. A house to protect her. The other people in the room looked at one another and giggled, but Wes did not flinch. His teacher smiled. "Great. Look forward to seeing it." He spent the next 7 months building his daughter's house from scratch. He sandpapered every board, hammered every nail, leveled every edge. When it was finished, the house stood 5 feet high and an arm's length across. It included shutters, a door, and windows. It was by far the most complex project in the group. When it was finished, it sat in the display room along with the projects of his classmates, including wooden plaques and a plain box that someone called a telephone base. To Wes, the house was more than just a project to complete. It was a daily reminder of why he was there. These past months have been the most important and enjoyable in Wes's life. He learned skills, gained confidence, and finally felt his life could go in a different direction. He stayed at the Job Corps Center so he could provide a better life for his kids. He stayed for his mother, who sat home watching Tony continue moving in and out of the criminal justice system. He stayed at the Job Corps Center for himself. After 7 months, Wes met his graduation from Job Corps with as much trepidation as excitement. No longer would he have to show up at the large parking lot on Sunday evenings waiting for the blue bus. No longer would he have to share a room with Levy, who after a troubled start was completing his GED requirements and starting his vocational classes. Wes would now be on his own. Wes's first job was as a landscaper at a home in Baltimore County. It was a temporary gig, and after 5 months he moved on to rehabbing homes in the city, another temporary job. After that, he worked as a food preparer at a mall in Baltimore. A year after completing the Job Corps training, Wes realized the only consistency in his employment was inconsistency. That, and the fact that none of these jobs paid over $9 an hour. One day, after completing his shift chopping vegetables, Wes took a detour on the way home. He went by his old West Baltimore neighborhood to pick up a package. He had stayed away from these blocks because he had been so busy since getting back from Laurel. He worked 10 hours a day and came home with barely enough energy to play with his kids and barely enough money to feed and clothe them. But the main reason he avoided these streets was that he felt they held nothing for him. He had changed. At least he wanted to believe that, and he continued to tell himself that as he walked through the blocks. He raised his head and acknowledged the many faces he had not seen for over a year. Wes was amazed as he watched how little the game had changed. The corner boy still pulling lookout, the muscle still looking as intimidating as ever. Wes watched as across the street, a young man no older than 16 pulled out a wad of cash, held together by a rubber band, and began showing it off to a friend. Lines of heads circled the block, looking for their next hit. Some of the players had changed, but the positions were the same. Wes finally got home and went immediately to his kitchen. He was living on his own now, in a small apartment. He placed the package he'd picked up on the table, sat down, and put his head in his hands. The pressure was breaking Wes down. Alicia complained that he was not giving her enough money to provide for the kids they shared. Cheryl was now constantly calling him about wanting more time with the kids, which meant she wanted more money to take care of them. His mother needed more money because she was raising both Wes's and Tony's kids. Wes banged his fists against the top of his head as his elbows rested on the kitchen table. While at the Job Corps Center, Wes had felt his problems floating off in the soft country air of Laurel. A year after graduating, he realized they had not disappeared. They simply returned to Baltimore, waiting for him to come back. In his absence, they compounded. Tears welled in Wes's eyes, but never fell. He realized long ago that crying does no good. He quickly rose and went to the sink to fill a pot with water. He ignited the flame on the front burner of his stove. While the water was heating, Wes walked to the front of his apartment and turned on 92Q, a popular Baltimore radio station. The last few bars of a Jay-Z song filled the room. When the streets is watching, the blocks keep clocking, waiting for you to break, make your first mistake. Wes returned to the kitchen. He reached in the refrigerator and pulled out the baking soda. Muscle memory kicked in as he tapped the side of the box and poured 3 ounces of the baking soda into the black pot, watching the powder swirl and fall to the bottom. He placed the baking soda back in the refrigerator. Taking a deep breath before picking up the package, he took a bound plastic bag out of the brown paper wrapping. He squeezed the package, testing its density. He reached over to the drawer that held his cutlery and pulled out a knife, brought the blade to the corner of the plastic bag. As the baking soda swirled in the rapidly heating pot, Wes held the plastic bag with both hands and poured in 9 ounces of cocaine. Chapter 8. Surrounded. 2000. The phone had been ringing continuously for 3 minutes. Mary sat on her sofa, unflinching. She was in no mood to talk, no mood to explain, no mood for consolation. She simply leaned forward, with her elbows resting on her knees, watching the television screen flickering just 5 feet in front of her. Her hands trembled. 10 minutes ago, a news report had stopped her cold. Mary didn't watch much television. She felt she never had time. But she just happened to have it on this evening. She saw file footage of a jewelry store she didn't recognize, its red brick exterior surrounded by police and yellow tape, accompanied by the newscaster's somber narration of events. Mary had been so busy that she was completely unaware the story had gripped the city for days. But as she sat on the sofa, she got caught up on what she had missed. 3 days earlier, in broad daylight, two masked men had run into J. Brown Jewelers, waving guns at the customers, ordering them to the ground. Customers screamed in fear and quickly followed their orders as two more masked men entered. These men carried mallets in their gloved hands. The gunmen scanned the room, their weapons trained on the terrified customers and employees, their heads swiveling, looking for any movement. They barked out orders over the screams of their victims. Following the robbers' command, the workers and customers pressed their faces to the ground.
"Keep your hands on the backs of your heads! I ain't playing with you!"
yelled one of the armed robbers.
"What do you have in your hands?"
another gunman yelled to a woman who had been talking on her cell phone when the four men ran into the store. With her arms outstretched and her torso resting on the ground, she slowly closed her phone, keeping her hands in open sight. The two men with mallets were oblivious to the pandemonium around them. They headed straight to the display cases that housed the watches and necklaces. Their decisive movement showed that they knew exactly where to go and what they were looking for. One of the people being held at gunpoint was Sergeant Bruce Prothero, a 35-year-old, 13-year veteran of the Baltimore County Police Department. Earlier that day, he left his wife and 5 children, ranging in age from 2 to 6, to work his second job as a security guard at the jewelers. After his wife had triplets, he needed to pick up an additional part-time job so she could stay home with the kids. He was supposed to be off that day, but was covering for a friend who needed the day off. He was known around the department as a man ferociously devoted to protecting his family and his colleagues. Sergeant Prothero was now being held by the neck, a gun pressed against the back of his head, his hands high in the air. He was unceremoniously forced to the floor with the others. After grabbing $438,000 worth of watches and jewels from the store, one of the robbers yelled, "Let's go!" and the four ran out to the adjacent parking lot, where a 1984 Oldsmobile Delta 88 and a 1987 Mercury Grand Marquis waited for them. Both cars had been bought a week earlier at an auto auction. Most of the people in the store kept their eyes closed and their heads on the ground. A few, including Sergeant Prothero, raised their heads to watch the men leave. Once the thieves cleared the door, these few quickly rose to their feet. Sergeant Prothero followed his instincts and ran out after the robbers. Drawing his weapon from his holster, he sprinted through the entrance. He looked around the parking lot for signs of the four men. He ducked behind cars, carefully peering through glass windows and above hoods. As Sergeant Prothero scampered behind the Delta 88 and began to lift his head, a black-gloved hand reached out the window holding a handgun and let off 3 shots, striking Prothero at point-blank range. Even after getting shot twice in the chest and once in the head, Sergeant Prothero stumbled off and ran about 10 feet, finally falling in the green bushes that surrounded the jewelry store. For the next minutes, he fought a losing battle for his life. The two getaway cars had long since screeched out of the parking lot. Crime in Baltimore and its suburbs had spiraled out of control.